Hi, this is Stu Cook of Creedence Clearwater, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, your shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
All right, everybody, welcome on back to Verbal Shenanigans. Mike Berlow, very, very, very excited about today. Very, very excited to get back on the what do we call this thing? Like
the shenanigans boat?
Maybe like a schooner?
The SS Shenanigans, ready to take off for adventures, Scotty.
It sounds so fun to be on, and but anyway,
sounds like that cruise ship in Norway that wrecked halfway through.
It would be like the fire festival of cruises. a lot of promise with no delivery. But everybody, welcome on back to Verbal Shenanigans. If you are just tuning in, I am Scott, and that is Mike there. You know, we are two guys, and that's it. No. We are.
That's a whole podcast. And if you like two men, you'll love Verbal Shenanigans.
And each week we basically have a very unique guest or guests on the show. We've had everyone from Mark Summers to Victor Wooten to a guy attacked by a hippo, who was more than one time on the podcast. So that's kind of our thing. And then we also like to dissect life a little bit and also be a little playful with some games and bits and whatnot. So we're a little bit of everything, and that's kind of the way we like it. Because honestly, I don't know about you, Berlow, but I would be bored if we were like one thing every week. Like if we... Like, I know a lot of good friends, they have a theme to their podcast, you know, like there's a thing they cover. That would be exciting for me for a little while, but I don't know if I could do 239 episodes of that. So, I like it.
So, we're not going to be doing the Leprechaun movie review podcast, like you promised me?
Well, we could do the podcast of that, but we're not going to go into a full themed Leprechaun-only podcast. I imagine the audience is limited.
Yeah, I mean, I guess after the ninth episode, one, we'd be done, and two, the audience would have been done around one third of the second one.
yeah, kind of like most of, kind of like our episodes now. So,
yeah, pretty much.
But anyway, I'd be knocking some what's the word? I'm like housekeeping out of the way. You could find us in a whole bunch of new locations before we get going here. Berlow, what's the name of the station we're on in Pittsburgh again?
We are on WHBJ-DB. That's Cutting Edge Talk Radio in Pittsburgh.
Correct. So we are Pittsburgh's newest, hottest podcast. We're blowing up in Pittsburgh. We got Steelers season tickets. It's pretty cool.
Yep.
Very excited to watch Big Ben this year.
Yeah, when we made the deal, we said, it's the Verbal Shenanigans, man. Get that Le'Veon Bell and Antonio Brown out of there. You don't need them. You got BBs and S's.
You got Brennan and Berlow replacing Bell and Brown.
But that's all you need.
We're in Pittsburgh, and then we're out on the West Coast over in Oregon and Washington, and we are on the Discover County Network, and we're in D.C. on the Coming Right Up Network, so we're starting to spread a little bit on different platforms, and then, of course, all your normal podcast platforms. But so I guess I had two shows this weekend, and that seems to generally be where I get my my stories from, because there always seems to be something interesting that happens. So Friday night was a fundraiser at a Freemasons lodge.
Okay.
Now,
what do Freemasons do, by chance?
I mean, as far as I know, they're just like weird Illuminati people. what they actually do. It's supposed to be like a fraternal organization that like is able to like trace back their their like origins or whatever back to like old stonemasons, like who made like different structures. And it's, listen, kind of what you're saying is what everybody what the hell do the Freemasons do? I actually happen to know two people that are in the Freemasons. And so you're going into that. Nobody really is exactly sure. You hear like the old rumors of the Illuminati and the triangle thing, right, and all that.
So long story short, their grandparents made Stonehenge. Gotcha.
Yeah, maybe. So show up to the event, and it's a typical kind of like a lodge, a VFW-looking place on the outside. And right away, go inside, say hi to the comics, and looking around, there is like there's like Bibles from like the 1800s and lots of old pictures of like, you know, painted white men. You know, like, you're not photographs, but like portraits of old crusty looking white men from the past. And there's a lot of weird rooms and old benches, and I'm like, you know, like right away I got that like, this is kind of weird, creepy vibe. And I wanted to, like, look around. So it was kind of cool because the show itself was going to be in the basement. So I'm like, okay, so we're upstairs kind of in what they're calling the green room, which is just, like, another room in the lodge. So show is getting close to start, and people are starting to go downstairs. And I decided, oh, I got to go back upstairs and go to the bathroom. And I'm like, well, I really want to kind of look around a little bit. So I peek in one room, and you may have seen the picture I posted. The first one, there's a bunch of spears on the wall, like very, very ornate, like just old looking like spears with weird tips on the top. Like there's probably like 8 or 9 of them. OK, and I'm like, well, that's weird. But, you know, like Knights of Columbus and VFWs, they got weird things, too, like weird hats and swords and stuff like that. But then I go,
spear really seems like the weirdest, crappiest medieval weapon I can think of. I mean, really? I mean, you gotta be with like really within like 2 feet of the person, or you gotta be the best javelin thrower ever to make that work
out. I don't know. Remember, you've seen Braveheart where they stab the horses with the spears and the horses go flying. It might be very effective against like a someone on a horse mount.
I need to like throwing stars or something like that. If I was a stone cutter or whatever the hell they are, I'd be like, nah, I'm not down. Just give me a gun.
Wait. So you would choose ninja stars over a spear? I feel like you're very limited.
Totally,
you're limited with your ninja stars. I mean, if you're not accurate, you're kind of screwed. At least a spear you could use as like a staff or a bow, and you could also stab people. And you could look at Morgan from The Walking Dead. He's still alive. I think I stopped watching.
Well, that's a wooden spear. That's not like your 1800s crazy spear going there with the Stonehenge people.
Was that the official? Was that the official name of those? The 1800s crazy spears? Like,
I think I read that in a book somewhere. I mean, that's how I'd call it.
Old Freemasons of the 1800s were outfitted with weapons such as all-time crazy spears and.
They were defeated by a cool man named Birdo with ninja stars. He knew what he was doing.
Birdo, who somehow got ninja stars from the samurai in Japan.
That's how I roll. I was in Europe. I'm like, this stuff ain't working for me. Let me look around. Ah, thank you, Asian people.
So, continuing forward. Now, I don't know if you saw the picture. The next picture is where it gets weird. It's this giant conference room, and all the chairs are on the outside walls of the room, like two rows facing the middle. And then there's like grand poobah chairs, like two guys that look like – it's almost like a king's throne, and then two guys a couple steps down from the king's throne. But the middle is what's really weird, man. The middle, there's like a checkered floor with like a I don't know, something with a tarp on it with candles around. Real, like, ceremonial, weird, like Eyes Wide Shut, like, some weird stuff goes on in this building. Like, I'm not really sure what goes on still. So really, I cleared nothing up by doing a I thought maybe I'd get it when I got there. Cleared nothing.
Hmm. Like, maybe if you rearrange the table and they say, hey, now we can't do X, Y, Z, then you'd be like, oh, that's what it's for.
Yeah, like the room.
Now I get it.
Yeah, like the room almost seems like the middle, like, could be like where they like sacrifice a goat or something like that. And I'm looking at like Wikipedia, Freemasons, and there is a picture of like George Washington kind of in the middle, the way like this lodge is kind of set up. So I'm wondering if it's like a throwback to that, obviously, of some sort. But so show's about to start. I am hosting. Okay. Now, before, so the comics were sitting there and this guy Franklin comes up to us. He's like, oh, I'm Franklin. Like, hey, how you doing? He's like, yeah, you guys want to hear a joke? And we're like, oh.
Scott, I just want to point out, any person who's walked up to a comedian say, you want to hear a joke, always gold.
Yes.
Never missed once. But go on.
And usually they're very, you know, original jokes, not like old-timey bar jokes that your grandfather told you. So, of course, he goes into, I'm telling you, it had to be 4.5 minutes long, which is, I want you people at home to think about how long 4.5 minutes is on one joke. It was, so a guy walks into a bar and he says this to this guy and he says this to this guy, you know, with a very minimal punchline at the end. So already I'm like, oh God, this guy's weird. So then I go downstairs to start the show. I'm about to go up and Franklin comes up to me. Okay.
Oh.
Franklin comes up to me, puts his hand on my shoulder, looks me in the eye and goes, I like you. He's like, I like you. I'm like, okay. I'm like, thanks. And he's like, you got really good geometry. You got really good geometry. You got good triangles. And that's what we're all about here at the Masons. Good geometry and structure. Mm. And I don't even know what to say. I kind of just like giggle and feel awkward. I don't know if he's complimenting me. I don't know. I don't know. Has anybody ever told you anything about your geometry, Berlo?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm looking over my rectangles, my eclipses, my cones. I mean, I like what I got here, but no, I've never been sexually harassed geometrically before.
Yeah, like did I just get me too'd? Like geometrically, I don't know. So I'm like, okay, whatever. The only thing that was great, I mean, the show was great. They were a great crowd. But I just turned it into my opening set was about 5 minutes making fun of Franklin. Like I was just like, guys, like, you know, I used to think these places were kind of weird and mysterious and creepy. And then Franklin came up to me and I was like, you know, he told me I got good geometry, and I'm like, you know, talking about it, I'm like, I don't know if this is all a ploy or he's, you know, he's just trying to hit on me. I said it a little darker words on the stage, but and like,
baby, I want to get into your octagon.
Well, it's funny because I'm like, Franklin, are you married, man? You are the creepiest dude I've ever met. And his wife's there. I'm like, did you guys meet at a sock hop? And he was like, you got a nice rhombus shaped booty, girl. You know, but it was awesome because they were like, all night people come up to me like, oh my God, I can't believe you went in hard on Franklin. We're gonna be talking about that all week. I'm like, okay, cool guys. And like,
you get the feeling all these Freemasons go into the meetings and. Oh, dear God, here comes Franklin. Jeez, what the hell is he going to bring up today? Hey, Franklin, how's it going?
Exactly.
A perfect circle? Yeah, thanks, Franklin. Yeah, been working on that. Good.
So, that's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping the meetings are like, you remember that comic that roasted Franklin on his weird geometry habits? Finally, someone had the balls to do it. But overall, it was a good show. But then, of course, at the end, a couple weird guys like, hey, you want to... You're interested in joining the lodge? I'm like, ah, oh, no, not right now, man. I'm just too busy. And he's like, well, you know, like you're, you know, you'd be perfect. And I don't know what that means. I don't know if this is still referring to my shape or this is referring.
I gotta be honest, looking at you right now, not knowing anything about Freemason, I would totally point at you and say, yep, that's you.
Thanks. I don't see again. These are these compliments that I don't. I don't know if they're a good thing or a bad thing. You know,
I think it's because you look good in a robe. I think that's my biggest thing right now. like I'm tied up to a chair. I'm like, what the F is going on and all? And then somebody comes out and it's you in a robe. And it's like, oh, now that makes sense.
So I would, if I
mean, I'm going to get sacrificed, but I mean, this this scene totally makes sense here for me.
So I'm giving off to you a very sacrificial vibe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, well, you're not wearing a robe right now, so I'm not feeling, you know, threatened. But if you came in here with, like, and you had a hood on with the robe, I'd be like, oh, man, something's going down.
I can't.
Some crazy spirits are going to come through the floorboard. I don't know.
I can't accept the robe into my wardrobe as an adult. I can't. Like, I got a couple robes from, like, doing the polar bear plunges over the years, and I just I can't graduate to wearing a robe around the house. It just feels like weird, you know.
It, like, you could pull off the have a robe on your back porch, looking out at the lake, drinking a cup of coffee.
Look. I don't think I could do it, man. I don't. I think
it would fit you.
I feel like
I
once
think
you go,
I got a challenge for you, my friend.
Once you
I,
go
I think
robe,
I'm gonna need that picture.
Once you go robe, I feel like you're like giving up a part of your youth. You're saying, you know what? I'm the guy who doesn't. That's when you start to not care what you're wearing.
No. I'm not saying going out in the public with it. I'm saying cup of coffee on your back porch looking at the lake. That's an Instagram photo, my friend.
All right. That can happen. Well, it's funny. The other day I put on the robe as a joke with Alex. I was like, what do you think? And then I actually fell asleep in the robe. So maybe that was my initial thing. But yeah,
I'm telling you. It might be a little strange, but the benefits, amazing. The people you meet, oh, my God. I'm like, okay.
Now, real quick, I had a show the next night. It was a fundraiser I put a fundraiser together for a friend's kids' baseball team and whatnot. And great show, great time, great lineup. Now, I normally, you don't usually laugh the next day about a joke or something like that. But my good friend, our good pal, KP Burke, host of the American Loser podcast. Great joke writer, very smart as far as the jokes. Good comic. You know, so there's our fundraiser audience, which sometimes can be a little tough, a little chatty or whatnot. And KP's got some edgy jokes and whatnot, so he says one joke, and he gets a little like, he gets a couple oohs and ahs. And KP Burke, I hope he's listening. So I'm in the back of the room sipping a beer. KP Burke all of a sudden says to a fundraiser audience, now keep in mind these are usually like, you know, a tad bit cleaner sometimes. He says to an audience, oh, hey, don't you better not be offended or else I am going to whip my junk out and me too this entire room, Louis C.K. style, and then I'm going to take a dump in the 50-50 box. And I don't know what it was. It was so primal, and it just came out of him. And I had just taken a sip of my beer, like it was halfway down my throat. And when he said it, I like erupted, and the beer got like caught. I literally almost killed. It felt like I was going to choke to death for a few minutes. And I have not, like, even today, we're recording this on a Monday. I'm still giggling to myself, thinking about what he said and the reaction to it. It was, they actually laughed because it was so insane and over the top. And he comes off the stage, he's like, oh, sorry for the Me Too thing. I'm like, nah, man, they went with it.
Yeah, as I can say, I stare at you and I can say Freemason, I could look at a picture of KB Burke and say, that guy pooped in a 50-50 jar. That's the kind of guy KB Burke is. One of the funniest SOBs, nicest SOBs on the planet. But he's a guy who can get those jokes out there and all, and it will just work no matter what.
Yeah, and he had a great set, and then Mike Burton killed. But it was just one of those moments, man, that I laughed so hard and almost died at the same time because I almost choked on a beer. But all right, I want to get to a very special episode today. I want to get to our guest here. Now, there's certain bands, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, bands that are kind of ingrained in the back of people's heads. Like, you don't even consciously think of them. You hear them all the time, everywhere. You've heard it since you were a kid. You've heard it in the car. You've heard it in movies. You've heard it in holiday. And there are bands that are just kind of ingrained in, music, just culture in general, I guess, would be the word. Kind of like we were talking about Michael Jackson the other week, but not, we're not going that way. We're not going.
I'm not sure our guests will really appreciate the comparison on that one. But continue, Scotty.
Well, we're not going into any more Burlew ice cream man stories.
All right. Thank God. When that first one came up, I'm like, uh-oh. We're arriving.
Go back last week and listen to that one. And one of those bands for me, I mean, I remember just always my dad having them on in the garage, and you hear them in like Vietnam movies, and you love their music, and they have so many hits after hit after hit, you don't realize it. And that is Creedence Clearwater. Creedence Clearwater Revival. I don't know a person on this planet that doesn't like Creedence, you know. Whether it's something from Fortunate Son to Proud Mary to, I mean, you name it. I was lucky enough to interview the bass player, Stu Cook. Okay. Mike was not present during the interview. He had that whole work thing to make money. But it was just a real pleasure. I mean, we got to sit, and you'll hear it in just a second. I sat and talked to him about Woodstock and what it was like to play with John Fogerty. And they've been doing – now, Woodstock was 50 years ago.
Jeez.
So now Stu Cook is the last tour for Creedence Clearwater Revisited, which is him and the drummer keeping the music alive. Now, John Fogerty tours on his own and does the music, but for a while there – Creedence Revisited was the only way you were hearing Creedence music. So really had the pleasure of talking to him, a man who has insane amount of experience. And I could have talked to him all day, but it was just a real honor to get him on the line. So here's our interview with Stu Cook.
Good morning.
Hey, is this Stu?
Yes, it is, Scott.
Stu, thank you. Good morning. And first off, thanks for giving me a couple minutes of your time, man. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
So, Stu, this is a big deal for me. Like, you know, I was just saying before I hit the record button that, you know, the songs of Creedence have kind of been, you know, before I was even into music, you know, my dad's playing them in the garage. It kind of always have been on. And even to this day, still play your guys' music, so it's pretty amazing to come full circle and have a few minutes to talk to you here. So I really appreciate it.
Okay, let's go.
Let's do it. Now,
yeah, man.
Stu, I got to ask. I played bass for a long time in bands, and I got to ask you, how did you pick the bass? Because it seems like every bass player I've ever talked to always kind of was, maybe they were the guy who, you know, someone had, they needed a bass player in a band and they kind of learned it, or there was an extra bass somebody had and they picked it up and fell in love with it. How did you start playing bass and not guitar or drums or whatnot?
Well, I was playing guitar. The Fogerty brothers were going to be the guitar players, and so I got to be the bass player.
See, there's always a story. It's almost like you get demoted, but then you love it.
It's the low four strings of a guitar, so it was an easy transition.
Yeah. So did you instantly fall in love with it, or did you take you a while to accept that?
Oh, I accepted it immediately, and you know, just tried to start working with it.
Well, you certainly came up with a unique sound. Like, you have a definite style that I find kind of unique to you. Now, when you guys were...
Thank you. I guess.
When you guys were coming up, did you guys ever have any ambitions that you were actually going to make this, or did it start as kind of just, you know, jamming in the garage kind of thing?
Well, we always wanted to make records, so that was the goal. But of course, you know, we were not any good. So, I mean, we had to learn what we could. You know, I've had some, you know, traditional musical training, and I used to play trumpet, and then I played piano after that.
Okay.
And but you know, guitars were what was happening back in the 60s, so I, you know, didn't play the piano anymore, but You know, the idea was to, you know, get good and make records and be on the radio.
Right. Well,
that took 9.5. Well, actually, we were making records all along, but before Susie Q, it was 9.5 years of learning and, you know, trial and error, trial and failure. Very little success, but, you know, each failure taught us something.
And what were you guys mainly doing? Were you doing bar gigs? Were you just playing house parties? Yeah. What was getting
anything? You know, we'd play for the boys' club. We'd play at the county fair. We'd play at fraternities. We'd any gig that we could get, we would play. Our high school sent us as emissaries to other high schools so we could play at what do they call those things? Assemblies.
Really?
Yeah. So we were like a little traveling band around the East Bay. It was great, you know, we'd get out of school.
Absolutely.
Throw the stuff in our cars and you know, go play it at a school down the road and then just take the rest of the day off.
That's it probably kept you from dropping out, you know? You
know, that's nah, I was always a good student.
So when you guys were, you know, before, like you said, Susie Q and that grind, what was your, like, writing style? Would you guys come with the Fogerty Brothers or John come with a song, or would you guys jam it out and write, or did everybody bring something? What was your general writing process to songs?
The general process, you know, for Creedence Clearwater was John would start working with an idea with a band, and, you know, he had an idea in his head of how the song would be structured, and we'd start playing, you know, through changes and then creating our own parts in many cases as we went along, and then, you know, then the song would be all together, then we'd go in the studio and cut it. Some stuff did kind of grow out of jams, particularly songs with jams in them, you know, like Grapevine.
Right.
Some stuff was more formally structured, so, you know, it varied from song to song, but, you know, Fogerty was the songwriter for the band, you know, during our big years.
Right. Now, when did you guys get an inkling that, hey, maybe, you know, like when Susie Q hit, or when did you get an inkling that, hey, maybe we can do this, you know, full time, maybe we have a chance at getting big? Now, then it was different, you know, you got a song on the radio, that was everything.
Well, we did it. We were doing it full time before Susie Q.
Okay.
We had started the year before, just about to the day, doing this full time. So that was, and you know, I guess that brought us quickly. We got there. The idea by doing it full time was to you know, actually have a shot. And you know, we had done it part time for nine plus years, and we didn't feel that we were getting anywhere, you know, it was taking too long. So that's when we decided to go full time from 67.
Mm-hmm.
And then Susie Q came out in 68.
And then it was from history from then.
Yeah, the rest, as we say, was entomology.
Right. Now, so when you guys actually, you know, you hit it big or whatever you want to say, What kind of life did you live at home, like as far as a family life? Or were you guys all just kind of single guys and able to do it? Or did you have girlfriends and wives that you kind of had to figure out how to make a relationship work while you guys are touring and doing, you know, every show under the sun?
I was single. The other three guys were married.
Wow.
So I guess they had to make it work. Yeah. It didn't matter to me.
You lucked out, I guess.
Well, I eventually became married, but I was single initially. So, you know.
So, you made it work.
I made it work.
So, when you guys, like, you know, you get to a point, like I was saying, I don't know many other bands that had as many hits as you. And you guys had so many hits that...
Oh, there's lots of bands that had as many hits.
There are. But there, you know, when you go through your guys' catalog, you almost start forgetting, oh, this song, like, oh my God, this song, oh my God, like, you guys wrote so many things. Was there like a, did you...
That only proves that you have a bad memory.
Well, that is 100%. That's completely true.
Yeah, no, I understand. You know, people don't keep track of all that stuff. You know, the more you're into something, the more you're likely to remember every song recorded by the Rolling Stones. You know?
Right.
But, yeah, most people are much more casual music listeners. So, you know, they hear a song and they like it, and then they hear another song. They like that one. They, after a bunch of songs, you kind of tend to forget the first couple that you like, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you guys have...
Your memory gets all filled up.
So, yeah, it's like a hard drive. There's only, you know...
Yeah,
you,
right.
Every once in a while, you got to dump some space, you know? Tell me about Woodstock.
Well, it was... interesting. You know, nobody knew what was going on. That was, by the way, if you recall, that was the summer of festivals. So there was Atlanta, mm-hmm. there was a Denver, there was a one in Southern, big one in Southern California. So Woodstock was just one of many that was...
giant festivals.
Yeah, that was, you know, part of the summer of 69. So... you know, they had a lot of problems finding a location. Finally found that location, and nobody wanted, you know, even a small group of people coming, let alone near 500,000. But anyway, they sold a couple hundred thousand tickets, I think, and, you know, the whole thing became just such a magnet for the culture that, you know, an extra couple hundred thousand people showed up without tickets. And so, the gates were crashed, as it were.
Yep.
And they had no choice but to let all these people in, and then they, you know, but they didn't have provisions or accommodations. You know, they didn't. I mean, they didn't have food and water for that many people, so they really had to scramble. I kind of look at the whole event as, you know, kind of a gathering. The music was supposed to be the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as it turns out, it was the audience that was the story.
Yes.
Because they, you know, the whole, if you've seen the film, you recall that, you know, it was mainly about what was going on with it, with the people who were there. The bands were sort of the backdrop. It was a different world for the artists backstage. You know, there was food and water and shelter, dryness.
Right. I was just going to ask, what were the conditions like for you guys?
There's a night and day. So, but, you know, the people kept it together for 3 days. There was no, you know, functioned pretty well as a society, little microcosm. You know, no crime, some, you know, a couple of deaths, a couple of births.
right, right.
You know, some...
What about for you guys? What was it surreal at a point, or did it, at that time, did it feel like another show or another festival? Like,
well, when we flew in, we were helicoptered in from the Holiday Inn where we were all bivouacked for the weekend, and we'd flown in from overnight from... L.A., we had just done the Dionne Warwick special or something like that. Andy Williams, I think it was Dionne Warwick. It was one of those television specials where you sit on a can, you know, like they create a set, right, some kind of theme, and then you perform your song or you lip-sync your song.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, the vocals are live and the music is canned.
Right.
Anyway, we did that. We flew all night to Boston, caught a private jet from there up to the Bethel, and then a helicopter from the Bethel airport into the Holiday Inn was, or then from there helicoptered into the actual concert site. But yeah, coming over the hill and seeing all those people was quite something, you know, unexpected.
So when you guys are playing, and you guys played at night, correct?
Well, we were supposed to play at 10, but if you recall, there was a lot of, inclemental weather creating electricity hazards, so the concert was hours behind schedule. So right. By the time we got on, it was like after a long Grateful Dead set.
Well, is there any, like one, any other
it was like
such
one
thing?
In the morning, 1 in the morning by the time we got on.
No.
And I thought we played okay. You know, we had some technical problems ourselves. But as I listened to the, you know, the recordings, several were, you know, really stood out. The rest were okay. But, you know, it was a journeyman set, I thought.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just got to be cool to, like, think about that when you were in the moment and then kind of be able to look back at it now and kind of the culture that's come around it, how they've tried to redo it a few times and how they've tried.
Yeah, they did. You know? Yeah.
So you play in something like the original Woodstock that is so iconic, not only just in the United States, but throughout the world as one of the big concerts ever, you know, it's ever happened. You think of things like Live Aid and Woodstock. What are your feelings about this 50th anniversary Woodstock that's going on, this new show? What are your feelings on it being done yet again? I guess this is the fourth time.
Yeah, I mean, what does the new Woodstock have anything to do with other than the name and maybe some geographical connection if they do it in New York?
Yeah.
I think there's one in Bethel and there's one in Watkins Glen. Michael Lang, the original producer, is doing the one in Watkins Glen, and I think the Bethel Council for the Arts or some like-named foundation or group is doing the one closer to where the actual site was, or maybe at the actual site. Not sure, but who would buy a ticket to see, you know, any of the guys that are still left alive for Woodstock play? Frankly, you know, it would to sell a ticket would have to be, you know, like a modern festival like Coachella or you know, some what's the one that the big one they have in
Bonnaroo.
Tennessee?
Bonnaroo. Coachella.
So it would have to have that kind of a lineup. And so what's Woodstocky about that? I mean, why you should not use the name Woodstock anymore, I think.
Change it up. So tell me when you, so you guys have been doing now Creedence Clearwater Revisited since 95, correct?
25 years.
So 25 years of doing that now. And you guys are still touring, you're still, you know, still going at it.
This is the final revival.
This is it?
Year. Yep.
Wow. What kind of feelings are going through your mind? Obviously it's got to be a bittersweet kind of thing.
Of course it is, but it's sweet, bittersweet. I mean, it's right. You know, another year playing, and there's the bitterness of it being over.
Yeah,
you know, at least as a regular touring band.
Right.
I'm not saying that we're not retiring. We're done touring. And then there's the sweetness of being able to move on and do other things. You know, I always look forward to. For a new challenge, something interesting to dive into, and I've done this all my life. So
I was going to say
I figure I've touched most of the the bases on this one.
I think you you're over what, over 50 years playing, over 60 years playing.
Well, this is this year is my 60th year of hanging out with Cosmo.
Jeez.
last year was Creedence's 50th anniversary. And this is Revisited's 25th.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I know. It's
So do you still, like on the side, do you still do write your own music or record your own music?
Oh, I mess around with songs, you know, trying to write songs. It's never been my passion. I have written some that came out well, but... you know, that it all fit. You know, when you're in a group, mm-hmm. like, and you have, you know, and you're actively, you know, working on new material for an upcoming recording. You know, there's a different kind of energy. I haven't been in that environment since the country rock band I was in, Southern Pacific, broke up.
Right.
So, you know, this is what we've been doing for the last 25 years is I would call a performance project. You know,
right.
It's a music project that Doug and I created to so that we could get out of the house and rock the fans.
Absolutely.
Frankly, you know, nobody had been playing. No original member had been playing Creedence music since the band broke up,
mm-hmm.
and it was, you know, so if you didn't see us before 72, you never got to hear any of the members play any of the songs until we started.
That's true. Do you guys have any contact with John anymore?
We have a business relationship with John that seems to be working, but there's been no interest that I'm aware of.
Putting it all back together.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's best left where it is. You know, I mean, there's many rivers to cross to sort that all out between ourselves. I don't think anybody
for sure
wants to dive into it anymore. You know, it is what it is, and at least we got the music right.
That's true. Let me ask you something. I always like to ask artists. You know, we talked to a lot of young artists on the show. Who have kind of always had streaming at this point, or kind of had digital platforms for a long time. Have you guys seen a whole new audience, of a younger generation, because music is a lot easier to grab and to play and discover and really dive in? You know, like, we hear a song on the radio, you can go dive into that band's catalog in minutes and hear every song they ever wrote. Do you see a resurgence among a younger group of people getting into Creedence?
You know, we've seen that from the beginning. Actually, our catalog has been spread over three generations now.
Yeah,
and we saw that right from the very beginning, and we had no idea. It was like, what are all these teenagers doing at our concerts? And after a year or so of this. The first year, 95 into 96, we started putting together that they had been, brainwashed. literally brainwashed by their uncles, aunts, brothers, sisters, parents. Anyway, the music was handed down, and it has stood the test of time. We're working on our fourth generation.
Oh, yeah, I mean,
and actually, we have more fans now, Creedence Clearwater Revival fans. I include Revisited fans. I mean, they're all Creedence fans. That's why we're successful, is because we have, Creedence fans.
Right.
As we lose them at the, the top end, the older end, we pick them up at the younger end.
And get them.
we really do have more fans all around the world now than ever before. It's crazy.
That's got to be a cool feeling. That's got to be really, do you enjoy, the fact that, with, social media and whatnot, I don't know how much you use it or you're on it, but that fans are able to kind of cut out a middleman and at least, at least reach out to their artists they like and see the lives of the artists. It used to be kind of a whole lot more, private, which is probably a good thing in some ways, but you could also, reach out to a fan. Like myself, I would never be able to talk to you right now if, I wasn't able to email and kind of set something up. So do you like that?
Sure. I mean, I don't mind. I enjoy talking to the press if the press, if the people are informed and present interesting questions and stuff like that. I want to go back to your digital comment, I might. For me, having my entire music catalog in my phone is just a blessing. I have my music with me everywhere. When it was home based, I didn't spend near as much time enjoying listening to music, as I do now. So the accessibility to so many different kinds of music.
And for sure,
has really changed the landscape of what people are listening to and which kind of artists. An artist, it's a much easier for an artist to find an audience, I think, now because of the connectivity that we're all experiencing. Portability and accessibility to such a broad
array,
selection of genres and different artists within those genres is amazing.
I can
become familiar with music from anywhere in the world, without having to listen to You know, I don't have to be in that location and be aware of them. I can just find them on the internet, right?
Yeah, I mean, is there any, like, young artists that you're into now that, you know?
I wouldn't call them young. I'm a big fan of the Queens of the Stone Age.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I like the Foo Fighters.
Absolutely.
you know, both those bands rock pretty good, write good songs, good players.
Yeah, I got to see them together a couple. Well, I guess it was more than a couple years. It was probably like 10 years ago. They were touring together.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I would love to see that.
Yeah, and Dave was doing. That was at the time where he was drumming on for the Queens of the Stone Age. So he did both sets.
Oh man,
yeah.
That guy's a wild man.
Yeah, he's a great great ambassador for rock and roll. It seemed, well,
absolutely. You know, I mean, and you know, I think the Foo Fighters, they're. Their group attitude is really admirable. You know, I've read some interesting interviews with them over the years, and you know, they hang together as a family.
Yep.
You know, they understand. You know, I mean, that band's been around for what, 2016.
Yep.
23 years.
Yep.
Foo Fighters, 23 years. Queens. Almost as long, in one form or another. So yeah, you know, I don't pay much attention to new music, new pop music.
Right.
It's not meant for my generation.
Yep.
So you know, I don't expect to find anything there. Bruno Mars is a pretty talented guy.
Yeah,
but you know, he's not even new, right?
No.
So I wouldn't know who is new. I just read about all the nonsense. You know, the new artists. They like to be in the media for misbehaving, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, even the music I listen to, it's like it's just new albums of old bands that I've loved for 20 years. You know, it's like I don't, not too many new rock bands that I found that I really love. But you know, they're out there. They are out there. But like you said, you know, you got all your music on your phone. You ever delve into your like oldest stuff and listen to it, or do you just like not listen to your music?
I'm sorry, say that again.
I was saying, do you ever delve into like your old music, or do you not really listen to your stuff?
Never.
it's funny how people do that, right?
Well, I mean, I referenced it when we were originally putting the Revisited project together.
Right.
You know, just to make sure that you know, we at least had a common starting point. But I didn't, you know, we've evolved in how we play these songs over 25 years. So, you know, I'm familiar with the music.
Yeah,
I don't really need to go listen to the actual recordings anymore.
Yeah. Before we go, what don't we know about you that you're into other than music? What do you do? What do you do outside of the music world?
I play golf. I scuba dive. I kayak. I paddleboard. I have an interest in photography.
Awesome.
I got 4 grandkids.
I'm sure that could eat up a lot of time right there.
Well, yeah, I mean, what I've just described is a pretty active life.
And absolutely.
I got a boat. I like to, you know, every once in a while throw a fishing line in the water. You know, I live in Florida, so it's pretty. Is it called the Sunshine State?
Yeah, yeah.
Although it's raining right now.
do the grandkids think it's cool that you're a musician, or they don't really care?
yeah, they have. A couple of my grandkids have a really strong interest in music.
It's awesome.
Already, so.
That's got to be cool to see.
Yeah, you know, one of my grandkids was just here for a couple of days, and. We always drag out, you know, let him play my acoustic guitar. I'll make the chords, and he can strum. And then, you know, we make up songs together. I've got a little boxed marimba that he plays on. So,
I love it.
Yeah, we jam together.
I love it. Stu, I don't want to take up all your time. I want to thank you so much for giving me a few minutes here. I really enjoyed talking to you and picking your brain a little bit and. You know, hearing just—I mean, you probably got more stories from 60 years of playing music that we could talk to you all day. But I really want to thank you for the time.
You're quite welcome. My pleasure speaking with you, and continued success.
Thank you very much, man. I appreciate that. And Wendy's awesome to deal with. So she.
Oh, that's great to hear. Yeah, I know. Wendy's been with us for years.
She's so good. She hooked me up with Chris Barron, too, from the Spin Doctors, and he did a really, really fun interview a couple months ago. And it's,
all right. Well, so yeah, she pitched you, she encouraged me to speak with you. She said that I would not regret it. So,
and she was wrong. No,
she had the right info, the truth, the word.
Stu, thanks so much, man, and have a good day. All right.
You too. Hey, adios, Scott.
Take care, man. All right, Mike. So that was Stu Cook, man. apparently your cat is a fan.
Big credence down here in Georgia for tailless cats. So,
I mean, if you just look at the hits from that band, it's absolutely insane. I mean, most bands would die for two hits, three hits. I mean, they have like everything you could possibly think of.
That's the kind of band where you make a top 10 and you think it's obvious the top 10, and then people are like, well, what about this and that? You're like, Oh,
right.
I can't believe I didn't remember that.
Right. And he was being a little modest on the interview, saying, oh, lots of bands have this many hits. Not a lot of bands, not a lot of bands have this many hits. I mean, you go down the line, and have you ever seen The Rain and Fortunate Son and Down on the Corner and Bad Moon Rising and Up Around the Bend and Born on the Bayou? And it's just endless amount. And it was kind of cool because this came through talking to a couple people that we have talked to on the podcast before, and one thing led to another, and I had to do the interview at a very specific time, early in the morning, and it just came. And then just this past summer, I had taken my dad as a present to see John Fogerty, who was obviously the lead singer and writer of Creedence music. So it's been pretty cool how things kind of come full circle. So
it's really incredible and all. There, I had an outside chance of thinking maybe I could do the interview, and I popped a tire that morning, so that went any. Well, I didn't pop it, but I don't know what happened. But basically, as I tried to pump it up, the stem came completely off of the tire, so I had to go through a whole process of getting the wife's car and trying to get it to work in time. So that pretty much ended all hope for Creedence. So,
well,
on the bright side, it was a boring day at work.
And on the bright side, Mike, you can listen to this episode anytime you want.
Yep, that is true.
I should cut it up and like insert your voice asking the questions, like. Like
just random stuff from other interviews that make no sense, and then just full silence in between.
So when you were on the 86 Mets, what was the parade like? Well, Woodstock was a great time.
You were a man pup.
But yeah, so that was Stu Cook and one of my favorites that we had to, favorite people that we've had on this show, or at least just a name that is very cool, because I've always really liked Creedence Clearwater, so pretty cool. So I don't know. I guess we can go a couple ways here. So a good friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, I've known her since first grade or kindergarten. I don't know. We've been friends for over 30 years, and she married another good friend of mine, Mike. So we're very close. And unfortunately, her mother passed away just this weekend. Very young, 61. Very sad. Battled with cancer for 8 years, and I'm not going to go into the whole thing, But thought it was, she was doing well, and then something happened, and kind of went the other way, and the poor woman passed away. But I don't know, man. It just had me thinking, and I don't know if this is like bringing the podcast down, but it had me thinking, like, I don't know, a lot about, like, kind of like mortality, I guess, or, I know we've had some of these conversations before, but I don't know, man. I'm starting to think the older I get, the worse I'm becoming with people dying and people passing away. Like, maybe it's not. Maybe it's hard to put it in. Maybe it's not the person actually dying itself, but maybe it's almost like, you know, kind of jolting my own mortality, like, you know, kind of feeling mortal or feeling like. Like, I was thinking the other day. So, five of my good friends have already lost a parent. And, you know, their age range from 30 to 40-ish years old, right? You know, and I think, thank God, I still got my parents still around. You still have your parents still around. But it's so, you know, to think that so many people are gone. And so, and you know, I look at my parents, and my dad is 68, I think. 68. I'd have to figure that out. 68. You know, and I think, wow, like, you know, 12 years from now, I'll be 80 years old. You know, 80 years. When you're young, I mean, even now, you think of an 80-year-old, like, wow, that's old, man. Like, very, I don't know what it is. I don't know if, do you ever get that? You ever get that feeling like, wow, like.
Well, I mean, when you're a kid, like, you look at somebody, they're your hero, they're huge, they're 10 times bigger than you. You think like 20 is old in your eyes. And also it doesn't even somewhat come up into your head and all, oh, this can be the time and all. When you get to your 30s and 40s, it's not even just like your friends. I mean, just like normal Facebook friends, somebody you don't even talk to, been in high school, you'll get that occasional, oh, this person died, oh, that person died, and it's just gonna add up. I mean, it's definitely something that creeps in my mind because, you know, I got a few uncles in their mid-80s, my dad will be 73 this year, so, I mean, it's not like I'm sitting back conscious, like tearing up, but it's something in the head. It's like I have to realize I'm going to be going to some bad places in the somewhat near future. Knock on wood, hopefully not for another decade or so minimum, but it is just a part when your number goes up. I mean, when you start realizing, like, damn, I mean, I'm 42. I sit back and say, man, if I double this age, you know, can I make it to double my age?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's I guess it's always that fear that every human being has in their life, you know, like, am I doing this right? Am I doing, you know, am I doing everything that I want to do or want to accomplish? And of course, I think the answer is always going to be no, unless you're like, I'm trying to think of who we did. Tom Brady's probably all right at this point, but like, you know, like, am I doing everything? Like, what am I worrying about? Like, should I pursue this full force or do the, I think everybody kind of look, should I travel more? Should I do, you know, I think everyone kind of has these moments along the way. And I don't know, for some reason, this one kind of just like shook some feelings up in me, like, damn, you know, like I need to start like, you know, start just doing what I want to do, you know, start, you know, not worrying about too much because like before you know it, it's going to be over anyway.
Well, I mean, 30s to 40s, that's where the midlife crisis has come in. And that's why you see some guy 45 with a Mustang and he's like, ah, I'm living life. And like some people are like, good for you. And some people are like, ooh, you're going to regret that at 55. But
So this whole thing was me really telling you guys that I just put an order in for a Corvette. That's what.
I was hoping you were going to say Corvette's our new sponsor. But. No,
yeah, me too. but I was also thinking, and this might also take a dark turn, and I think we've talked about it, but could have been 100 episodes ago for all I know. What do you want done with yourself when you're gone? What do you want Berlew's body to go? What do you want the experience to be like?
I'm the kind of guy, I really don't want people just like mourning me or it's kind of like, remember the surprise birthday party you threw for me where it's, I'm not a guy who I'm going to say, hey guys, you know, it'd be cool. But when it happens, it's kind of emotional. I'm kind of laid back. I mean, really honest, I wish I could make a deal with the mortician or whatever and just be like, listen, burn me up, throw my ashes somewhere, and just when everybody's in the funeral home, just be like, Merlu's gone, go home.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a hard thought. Like, I still don't even know if I want to do, you know, the whole cremation thing, or I want to go in a box somewhere. I don't really think about it that way. But I guess, like, at some point in your life, you have to start thinking about this, right? Because otherwise, you're a burden to others at some point. Like, they got to make decisions mm-hmm. for you. And who knows? Doesn't matter what I do with myself. Can I shoot myself into the ocean out of a cannon? Can I do one of those things where I become a tree, where you plant me and I become a tree? I don't know. I feel like I would want like a combination of people kind of celebrating, but also being like really sad, like, oh, Scott's gone. Like, because I feel like your selfishness would come and be like, Burlo's not even sad. He's over there. you know, like if you're able to like sit over your body and watch your wake, like, Burlo's over there talking. He's talking.
Yeah. I'm just going to be staring at your body. It's my podcast now, Scott. It's immortal shenanigans, buddy.
Yeah, like I want to be able to look over and be like, oh man, like, you know, my sister's not even sad, she's joking around, you know, like who actually cared, who didn't. I don't know. It's just a weird thought. I think that it's hard to, I guess, put exactly in words, and I hope I'm making myself somewhat understandable or clear, but
I think where it boils down to is when you get to an age where you're like, all right, I know it's coming sometime soon. You got to know what you're comfortable with, how you want the last vision to be, you know? Right. I mean, some people just sit back and say, I want everything and everyone. Some people just want to be like, don't even bother. I mean, probably the best thing is to make sure you get the word however they do it, and all. You guys better have some fun. You better have some laughs. You better have some chats.
Yeah,
and get on and remember me, and then get on with your life.
Yeah. Are you? I guess last morbid question here. Are you frightened of death?
I don't know.
I am.
I think that is the best way to say it. I mean, like, I feel young.
Right.
Again, as I look at, I don't look at age, but I can, as I just said earlier, I mean, I'm 42. Can I get another 42? Who knows? I got some pretty good genes in my family because, like I said, a lot of them were in their 80s and 90s before they passed, but, I mean, I try not to dwell on it.
No.
I mean, once in a blue moon, I think about it. To be honest, sometimes I think more about, like, my pets, not in the sense that I don't feel for, like, my family, but still in my head, I still play the game of they're healthy, they got no issues, my mom and dad run around and do bikes and stuff like that. No. I should be able to get another 10, 15, 20, hell, I hope 30 years. Who knows?
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of the thing. Like, once in a while, I look at Callie, and I mean, they told us when we got her, she's 2, so she would be 4 right now. But obviously, when they get them, they're not 1,000% sure. Nobody has any birth certificate, so there's like a point.
Was she Dominican and like a pitcher in the major leagues? Like, were you like Bartolo Colon?
Well, we went to a Freemason place and we looked around. We saw a picture of Callie up here. We're like, what the hell? So, but
like Bartolo Colon could be 47 or like 63.
It's just going to be cockroaches and Bartolo Colon when the world ends, people. Just admit it. Just admit it.
Doesn't sound too bad. But
that would be pretty cool. I mean, I'm going to write that story, but still.
I don't know, man. I think the older I get, the more... The more when I do sit, like you said, I don't sit here and I don't know if it's coming off like I sit here and actively think about this all the time, but every once in a while there's an event or something that kind of sends you down a wormhole into thinking you know, strangely or whatnot. And I don't know, man. I fear it. I fear it. I feel like more than I did when I was younger. And maybe that's normal because I'm getting older. So maybe it becomes more of a real tangible thing, you know? So.
Well, you just got to live life as best you can. And when it comes, buddy.
Right. Here's what I want when I die. I want every one of my friends and family to be locked in a room with me, you know, up there. And all the episodes of Verbal Shenanigans have to play from start to finish.
And we should make it like an escape room. So when people start panicking, it's like, well, if you listen to episode 112, you would have got your first clue. But no. You tried to go to the bathroom.
It was Zap. It was Zap was the clue. but yeah, well, we can, you know, I always like a good life talk, but we could brighten it up a little bit here, Berlo. What do you got?
Well, we're going to brighten it up by bringing up another dead person, Scotty.
Oh, yay!
But as we tried to get different guests in our days, you know, I was trying for wrestler King Kong Bundy, and sadly, it was about 3 weeks ago he passed away, two or three weeks ago.
Something like that, yep.
Yeah, so, but we're not talking about him specifically. What I found is he's a Jersey guy, and there was an article how they're trying to find homes for King Kong Bundy's cats. It was from Perfect Angels, and it's P-U-R-R, as you expected, Perfect Angels Cats Rescue, Inc. He had three cats, Pat, who's 15, Paige, who's 10, Stewie, who's 8, and I believe them and Gloucester County Animal Shelter are trying to find homes for these cats. So if you're a wrestling fan or just a cat fan or just want to do good, and before we get in our little bit, you know, check them out and give them a good home and all. The cats deserve it. But
I wonder if all their did King Kong Bundy have the chest hair? Or was that George the Animal Steel I'm thinking of?
That was George the Animal Steel. King Kong Bundy was bald.
Yeah, he
had the singlet. He faced Hulk Hogan WrestleMania 2. He was on Married with Children.
Yeah. I always confused the two of them. The other one died a couple years back. So.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. But it got me to thinking, Scott, a little game.
How many cats can you adopt?
We're going to see what celebrity animal would you end up with.
Okay.
So for whatever reason, you and King Kong Bundy were good friends, and he put in his will you had to take his three cats.
Okay.
So right now you have King Kong Bundy's three cats, but I'm going through some celebrities with some of their weird animals, and I'm going to see, are you going to trade in King Kong Bundy's cats for these other celebrity animals?
So I'm starting with three cats. So I got three of King Kong. Now,
three of King Kong Bundy's cats, and you got to tell me, well, I would prefer that animal over King Kong Bundy's cats.
Okay, quick question. When I trade in the cats, is it a three cat trade? Like, are they in a bundle? Or can I break out?
You're going to fully get this new celebrity. For whatever reason you come up with, you think it'd be funny, you think it'd be cool, it'd be an adventure, whatever reason, it's all up to you, Scotty.
No, but what I'm saying, can I split the cats up? So can I, like, keep a cat and an orangutan? It's three. Okay, it's all
no, you
all
gotta
or nothing.
Get the full package, my friend.
Okay, you gotta keep them together. Gotta keep the family together, little King Kong kitties together.
Yeah, so we're doing celebrities throughout history. So
All right.
Your choices are King Kong Bundy's cats or Kirstie Alley's pet lemur.
Okay. Is there any background to this lemur? Do we know anything about it?
I couldn't even find a name on it. It's just apparently the girl from Cheers has lemurs.
Well, this is tough because I'm not the biggest cat guy in the world. I've lived with cats before. They're okay. I don't mind them. I like a cat that's kind of chill and will let you pet them. But I don't, the skittish ones, like, that's how I ended up getting bit by one. So three of them. What if all three of them are weird and kind of – I mean, King Kong Bundy didn't seem like the most normal dude in the world. But I don't know much about lemurs. So I feel like I got some experience in case these cats suck. Like, I've been bit by a cat. I've had to – I mean, I told you this story a long time ago. Me and my buddy Alex, we found a bunch of cats in a box, and we thought that we were like – our parents are going to be so happy that we brought these cats home and, like, like we were going to rescue them. And, like, my mom's like, get them out of here. Like, she hated cats. And then my buddy Alex's mom was like, yeah, okay, so. And, like, we ended up having, like, walk to the vet. And then we thought the vet was going to be like, you guys are great, amazing. And they were like, oh, like, you guys can't keep them. like, they did not want them either. And lemurs got weird eyes. So I'm going to – so far, I'm keeping King Kong's cats.
Okay. Okay. Very
that was the
good.
That was the longest description of of why I would keep the cats. But
all right. So we're going to do a cat for cat battle. So we got King Kong Bundy's cats versus the Church of Satan's founder, Anton LaVey's lion, whose name is Togare.
I got to stick with the cats, man. I am not messing with it. We see how this ends. We saw that lion that ripped that woman out of the tour bus and killed her. We see what happened to Siegfried. I don't know if that was a lion or a tiger. I don't remember. Or Roy. One of them. One of them got bit. I feel like life or death, I could still fend myself against three cats.
Okay.
The lion snaps. It's over.
Gotcha. All right. It was Siegfried, by the way.
Oh, okay.
All right, so we're still with King Kong Bundy's cats. All right, for your next one, King Kong Bundy's three cats or Theodore Roosevelt's one-legged rooster?
this is almost like your uncle.
My uncle did not own a rooster. He was a one-legged man. Let's get that story straight for another day.
He did love cock. But I don't like birds that much, like pet birds. I feel kind of weird about like birds in cages. I feel like that's, you know, they want to fly around and they're just kind of sitting there. But a rooster, I don't know. I guess a rooster you can kind of keep out on the if you got other chickens and whatnot. But I feel like a rooster, pretty annoying in the morning. And I'm just not in love with the rooster. And then what happens if that other leg starts going? Then I got to feel guilty about this stumpy, like, rooster mess that I just have to take care of that can't really move. And he just starts to gain weight and things start to get a little weird. And then before you know it, I'm at home like, guys, I got to run. I got to go take care of my legless rooster. And I know I have no social life. And knowing me, I can't kill animals. So I'm going to stick with the cat still.
All right. So since you're not a bird person, I think I know the answer to this, but I still enjoy this matchup.
Okay.
Scott, are you going to keep King Kong Bundy's three cats? Are you going to get Mike Tyson? Now, we know Mike Tyson owns a tiger.
Right.
But I'm not giving you the tiger, Scott.
Okay.
Apparently, Mike Tyson has thousands of domesticated racing pigeons.
Pigeons, yes.
Yes, racing pigeons.
Yes.
So do you... Three cats versus thousands of racing pigeons, Scott,
right,
from the world heavyweight champion.
Here's my thing. Mike Tyson was known to train those pigeons and, like, to do different things and race, and he was able to do that clapping thing. Like, remember that scene in what's the movie? A Training Day? Where they're driving into, like, the ghetto, and there's a guy on the roof clapping clapping the birds to signal, like, danger. I mean, if I got 1,000 trained animals, I'm starting to think that maybe that's like almost like an army that I could amass. And then from a financial perspective, I could take each one of those and sell them individually. And all of a sudden, I have 1,000 racing pigeons to sell to other pigeon racers. And before you know it, I maybe make profit, or you come to my house and I got like 1,000 pigeons guarding that place. So trading the cats, taking the pigeons.
Wow. That's an upset.
That's correct.
This just tells me Obi is not doing his job if he's getting replaced by birds.
My dog is the least thing from a guard dog you can imagine. So,
all right. So right now we have Mike Tyson's thousands of domesticated racing pigeons, and they're going up against Vanilla Ice's Wallaroo and Goat, Bucky and Poncho.
Wallaroo. So, like a kangaroo-wallaby mix?
Wallaby, hybrid.
So the birds, there's the kangaroo and a goat. So
correct.
All right. So here's my thinking. Now, I have these 1,000 pigeons that are trained. They're already trained, okay? They're one species, so I'm imagining the care for one pigeon is the same as the care for 1,000 pigeons.
Can't fathom it getting mixed up between pigeons.
Right. So a kangaroo and a goat, that's two different species. I didn't even know you were allowed to have kangaroos or wallabies. And I'm kind of flashing back to that video a couple years ago where the guy punched that kangaroo and that kangaroo ate that shot like it didn't matter. Again, self-defense, I know I can take a bunch of pigeons. I don't know if I could take a wallaroo or anything like that. So I'm going to keep the pigeons.
Interesting.
Yes.
All right. Well, a couple more for you, Scotty. Mike Tyson's thousands of domesticated racing pigeons versus former First Lady Grace Coolidge's pet raccoon, Rebecca.
Oh, God. This is terrible. Pigeons or raccoons? Well, one time when I was a manager at the pool, we had to go and go into the filter room, which was like, I don't know if I ever told you this. Like, we were 18 and 19, me and the other guy, the manager, and I was the assistant manager. And they would like make us go, and like, it's a big outdoor pool, like a YMCA pool. They would make us, like, we're sitting around in flip flops and lifeguard bathing suits, pour like vats of acid into like the filters and stuff like that. Like, and these are in the big containers that like were really heavy. And if that like got on you, you're definitely burning yourself. Like, very dangerous. And they just expected us to do that somehow. Meanwhile, usually
well, worth $7 an hour.
Right. Exactly. But one time we went in there and there was a raccoon living in there. And we opened that door and it was like 3 inches from my buddy's face. Like, when we opened the door and it was like, and then like the whole day we're trying to figure a way to get it out, and it did not budge. It just kind of stared at us like, okay, I want to see you get me out of here. So I'm going to stick with the pigeons, man. The raccoon shook me. Rebecca the raccoon might not be as bad, but raccoons got me shook, a little mentally shook from years ago.
Yeah. I feel, you know, they're cute as hell and all, but they are nasty if they want to come after you.
Yeah.
All right. How about Mike Tyson's thousands of domesticated racing pigeons versus Paris Hilton's kinkajou?
Oh, a kinkajou. They got cool tails.
Here's a picture of one for you if you weren't aware.
Right. Yeah, I know. They got cool tails. They kind of hang. They're like Australian animal. This could be tough because now I could finally get rid of these 1,000 birds. That
you've been holding them for a while now.
These 1,000 birds that I assume are pooping all over the place. I'm assuming it's becoming pretty full time job that I got to take care of these things.
That's true.
And you know, I could have sold them off, but maybe I just want to get rid of the headache, kind of like a yard sale. Like, you just want to get this stuff out of your house, and now I can just take this kinkajou that kind of looks like he's hanging around. I'm hoping he's not like Paris Hilton, but I'm gonna get rid of these birds. And I'm going to take the kinkajou.
Oh, awesome.
plus, there's another reality show, Paris Hilton living with 1,000 of Mike Tyson's trained racing
birds. This is gold, Scott. End this recording. We got to make this happen.
You can't see that coming on right after, like, Keeping Up with the Kardashians or something on Bravo. it would be a hit. Paris and the Pigeons. Boom.
Damn. All right, so you have Baby Love, the name of Paris Hilton's kinkajou.
Oh, you didn't tell me that part.
The final matchup is the kinkajou or Audrey Hepburn's fawn Pippin.
A deer, huh?
Yeah.
Pippin.
I think I've said on the cast before, if I got really rich, I'd have a pet deer. If I hit that Powerball, I'm luring one into the house.
Burlo, here's the thing, though. Like, I don't think you need the Powerball to lure one into the house. I think you need a freaking carrot.
Well, I have to pay for the house after I get it in. I didn't say it domesticated yet, Scott. Come on.
So you need to hit the Powerball to build
this
deer Transformation Center.
Babe,
is that you?
I got $700 million, so I just want to tell you that before I explain what's in the garage right now.
Burlew's Domesticated Deer Center. Bring your deer.
We'll train your deer.
Bring your deer wild. Comes out a cuddly pet.
Ask Aubrey Hepburn.
In just three payments of $299 and 1 week of training, Burlew's Deer Farm will give you the cuddly Bambi-like creature that you have always desired. Burlew's Deer Farm. Check us out. Babe, you spent all $7 million of our winnings?
To be fair, it was $700 million, but yeah. Babe, let me explain.
Babe, turns out the deer farm wasn't the greatest idea. We're bankrupt.
Yeah. It turns out I'm the only person that wants a deer.
You know what? I like deer. I like moose a lot. But I feel like a deer can really wreak some havoc. Like, I know they don't do well in captivity. I've heard that before. That could be made up. But he's got a cool name. Pippin's kind of a cool name. But I feel like a Kinkajou might kind of, like, lounge around and become my friend. And I feel like I could change his name. He doesn't have to be Baby Love forever. I'll just call him the Jew.
I don't know. I see you in your robe having your sip of coffee on your back porch with your Kinkajou
right
on your shoulder and saying, how are you doing, baby love?
I see the weird image that you're projecting for me, like that I could kind of like just start losing it and wearing a robe and having exotic animals. And I see where you got my future going. And all that mortality talk, that would probably lead like to a couple wild years of drugs and partying, and that would be it for me. You're just trying to get the cast from me. That's what you're.
I don't know what you're talking about, man. Just live the dream in your robe and your Kinkajou. That's all I'm saying.
You're trying for me to get weird and go down a path that I don't want to. But I am going to keep the Kinkajou. Final answer. It's unfortunate.
All right.
And in fact, me taking it from Paris Hilton is kind of like me rescuing it.
Gotcha. You're a good person, Scott.
Thank you.
Well, I'm sorry for King Kong Bundy's three cats. I will implore people, go to Perfect Animal Cat Rescue, Inc. and Gloucester County Animal Shelter. Give those cute kitties a home. He was a good man. Those cats deserve it. But, Scott, you're going home with Baby Love, the Kinkajou.
Baby Love. All right, guys. It's been a good cast tonight. Burlew, I just wanted to, like, real quick before we get on out of here. I like these, and I don't know why I never really brought these to the cast, but I like reading, and I guess this kind of ties in well with our talk from before, but I like reading words that the definitions for things that you've never been able to kind of put in words. I don't know if you've ever seen any of these, but I kind of like them. And I figure I'm just going to read, like, I don't know. I'm just going to read one. And, you know, maybe for the next couple of weeks, I kind of like these. So this one is a noun, and it's called onism. You ever hear the word onism? So it's spelled, or maybe it's oneism. I don't know. Onism. But it is the awareness of how little of the world you'll experience. Imagine standing in front of the departure screen in an airport, flicking over with strange names like other people's passwords, each representing one more thing you'll never get to see before you die, and all because, as the arrow on the map helpfully points out, you are here. So, Burlew, have you ever experienced onism before? Because I have.
Well, you say your example. Let me think of one.
No, there's been many a times where I'll sit in life and say, oh, my God, I'm in my mid-30s, and I've only been to New Orleans, Alaska. Like, I'll start, like, counting how many places I've been to, and I'm like, damn, every year I go on the vacation to the one spot. Like, should I be going to different places? And all I see these travel shows, and I see people traveling all over the place on Facebook and Instagram, and it gets me a little jealous. And I'm like, man, will I ever get to the African safari? Will I ever see China? Or will I go to Russia or all these weird places? So I've definitely experienced that before.
I think with, like, experiences in general, and I'll just somebody going, oh, I went to Vegas and I went hot air ballooning, and oh, I drove race cars over there, and all, just something that's it's almost like, oh, man, and I'd love to put on a bucket list, but I know as much as you say the bucket list, you know, three quarters of them, unless you have some spare cash or you spare time, you're never going to get to it. So I guess that's my onism, Scotty.
Yeah. All right. One more, and then we're out of here. This one's called Fitzcarraldo. A Fitzcarraldo. It's a noun.
He's a guest for next week.
We're here with Fitzcarraldo. It is a noun, and it is an image that somehow become lodged deep in your brain. So maybe washed there by a dream or smuggled inside a book or planted during a casual conversation, which then grows into a wild and impractical vision that keeps scrambling back and forth in your head like a dog stuck in a car that's about to arrive home, just itching for a chance to leap headlong into reality. So kind of like an image that stuck with you and kind of just kept almost growing, basically. Ever experienced that?
As for, like, dreams, I remember as a kid I had an ongoing, like, dream where, like, I'd be doing something and we're running out of time and I would start hearing, like, music in my dream, like, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, almost like a video game, right. Like, you're running out of time thing.
Yeah.
And I knew something would come in, and, like, the dream would end with, like, a door would open and there'd be a witch on the other side that did a lap, and wow. I would just, like, wake up.
So the witch would show up multiple times?
Like, that would be the ending. Wow. Like, I guess in some way I'm like, oh, my God, the witch is going to get us. And it'd be something like normal, just like, oh, my God, we got to get this book report done. Hurry, hurry, hurry. And then the witch would show up. Like, damn it.
Yeah. Huh? So there you go. I can only think of, like, two, really. One, like, old one and one new. One, I know I've told it. Oops. I know I've told this on this show. But I've had many dreams about my teeth falling out, which I know is common. I've also had this dream constantly about going over this bridge by where I grew up, losing control of the car, and I just slowly – not even slowly, I just falling down into the river. It's the ocean, I guess, technically. And that always – that's happened many a times. I do recently – I remember an image that shook me up. I think I told this also on the cast – I had this dream of this very pale woman with, like, ginger eyebrows and ginger hair. No, it wasn't me. Very pale. And it almost looked like a little bit – remember, like Johnny Depp's Alice in Wonderland, Mad Hatter kind of look almost in a way?
Yeah.
But a very old woman, and she came, like, out of nowhere and tried to stab me. And I, like, was, like, freaking out, like, where my fiance had to wake me up and was like, babe, like, I was freaking out. And that, like, image, like, kind of stuck in my head for a couple of days, I remember, and I still kind of can picture it very, very clearly. And then I also remember as a kid, like, I remember the first time seeing Schindler's List. And you remember, I think I've only watched it once since then, like, but I remember the scene where the kids are in, like, the latrine. Like, underneath the porta potty, and they shine a light in there, and they're hiding. And I remember that, like, sticking with me so much. And just remember that, like, creeping me out back in the day as a, you know, when I was young. So that's what that kind of, that's my Fitzcarraldo, Berlew.
Yeah. The old lady you were describing, I see that as your origin story for the stonemasons. Like, yeah, this recurring nightmare. What could it mean? And then you join the stonemasons, and then you go on this adventure, and you have to defeat the evil lady. And she's like, I know your triangles aren't perfect.
Well, I think on that note, Berlew, I think it's time to head on out of here. I had a lot of fun today on the cast.
It was very enjoyable, very topical.
Yes. A lot of conversations. So I'm going to keep up with these little emotions that you feel that, you know, you feel but you've never really had a word for them. So maybe each week we'll just pick one or two and talk about it for a little bit. Brings on some interesting conversation. So, Berlew, anything to promote besides King Kong's Bundy's Cats before we get on out of here?
Yeah, I will. We're doing a little podcast promo sharing out there. So I'm going to talk about Release the Clowns Comedy Sketch Podcast. The show that delivers 15 minutes of peak UK sketch silliness every other Monday Find it on iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, YouTube, and a host of other platforms, and on Twitter at ClownsHQ.
And I guess I will quickly promote April 13th once again. For the first time ever, I am doing a comedy at a cat themed at a cat convention. It's going to be all comics that have some kind of cat bit. It's in Asbury Park, so it should be a good time at the Wonder Bar. It's in the middle of the afternoon, so it should be a good time. And if you want to go back, listen to the episode with DJ Bornshine and get some info on that. And real quick, we'll promote, since we brought him up today, on his amazing way to charm a fundraiser crowd, go check out KP Burke's podcast, American Loser. Very interesting. It's kind of cast about history and a comedic take on it and try to figure out who the loser is and whatnot. So it's just a good one if you like history. And that's it. And check us out on all these different platforms and whatnot. Just Google us and like us, okay? Like us on and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and whatnot. And lastly, I got to thank Stu Cook for, allowing that interview to happen. And really just a guy I never thought I'd get to talk to in my lifetime. And just a really good time tonight. So good cast tonight, Mike. Life is funny. Laugh at it. And keep the wind at your back. Adios.
Later.